On the afternoon of the 26th of July 1993, Haran and Megan Tews, an elderly couple living on a farm in Wales, were murdered. They were both mercilessly shot in the head and their bodies were hidden in the barn of their own property. Over 30 years later, the only suspect police could possibly identify was their own son-in-law. This is the case of Harry and Megan Tews.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
So let's talk about Harry and Megan Tews. They were basically an older couple. They were living on a remote farm just north of Llanharry in South Wales. Beautiful part of the world. I used to live in South Wales. Llanharry is sparsely populated, like I said. It's surrounded by farmland. About 3,000 people actually live there. And this will take your breath away, because crime rates in certain places in the world are very low, but Llanharry really does take the biscuit. So in the 60 years before the crime that we're going to talk about today, before 1993, crime was basically unheard of. In fact, there was only one break-in recorded in the 60 years before 1993. That entire time, the only crime that was recorded. If you want to get a job as a police officer and have spare time, Llanharry is the place for you. Now, when we get to 1993, when this crime occurs, Harry is age 64 at the time and Megan is 67. Harry was really well known in Llanharry. The reason for that is he'd owned a market garden business, so everybody knew who he was. It's a low population, he's popular within the local environment and community, and he served a purpose locally to lots of people, so he's a personality that people know. He'd retired 7 years earlier, and this is when his only daughter, Cheryl Tews, had actually moved away. And it's said that what he did a lot of in his spare time was he grew cabbages on the farm. So he's very much somebody who's connected to Mother Nature and the earth, and he obviously takes great pride in his growing. And when people were asked to describe the kind of life that Harry and Meghan had lived, people described it as an uneventful life. But I would like to reframe that. I think what's being said there is that Harry and Meghan had had a very calm, contented experience. There hadn't been anything too traumatic. There hadn't been anything untoward. They'd connected with their community, they'd done well in their life, and there was nothing that stood out about either of them that could be easily criticised. So their end is at a complete distinction to their lives, because up until that point, there is nothing that is so traumatic or devastating that it stood out in any way, shape or form. Now in 1992, which is 1 year earlier to what we're going to talk about today, there was an incident. So Harry's shotgun, which he had because he was on the farm and he would use it to shoot rabbits, it was mysteriously stolen. So that in itself is strange. It's unusual that somebody would break into any home, because arguably in the local area, that just doesn't happen anyway. As I said, crime just doesn't occur. But it's very specific. And you would imagine that if somebody's going to burglarise a home, they're going to come in, they're going to take numerous items. They're not going to just specifically go for a shotgun. So you could suggest, therefore, that it's likely somebody who knows the property and knows that he has a shotgun. And that's why that specific item and only that specific item is taken. Then let's fast forward to the actual day of the killing. So this is Monday, the 26th of July, 1993. And I would say the Tewses are going about their life in that absolutely normal manner. First of all, they leave the farm in the morning, they go and get their pensions in Llanharry. They then go shopping at the local Tesco, and Harry actually bumped into one of his sisters. She said, look, when I reflect on our interaction, the final interaction we were ever going to have in this planet and universe, he was acting absolutely normal. There is nothing suggestive of him having some kind of psychotic break or acting in a way that suggests that he's in a very low state or that there is anything provoking any level of anxiety within his nature. He's just absolutely the same as normal. The couple then arrived back at the farm around 11 a.m, and this is completely contextual with their normal habits. But then around 1:30 p.m, two shots are heard by neighbours, and those shots were 30 seconds apart. But they didn't really think anything of it, because Harry was often protecting his cabbages, and the way he would do that was he would shoot rabbits. So when they hear those gunshots go off, they just think he's up to his normal behaviours. Cheryl Tews, their daughter, She rings the house at 3 p.m, but she gets no answer, and that's unusual. She then tries again. She rings her parents because they usually have a nightly phone call, but they don't pick up. And again, this is really, really strange. Now, she's immediately concerned. So she actually speaks to Tuesday's neighbours. They then notify the South Wales police. But that in itself speaks volumes, that Cheryl, the daughter, knows there has to be something wrong, because there's absolutely no way that her parents would fail to fulfil the habit that they always keep, which is that nightly phone call. And also because there have been hours that have passed since she tried calling earlier and there's still no answer, she's probably thinking one of them could have had an accident or they're both not very well. It's just wanting to make sure that her parents are safe. The police, they do go out, they get to the home that they live in and they go to see whether they can note anything untoward. And it's harrowing because they quickly discover Harry and Meghan's bodies, not in the home, in a cow shed on the farm, literally buried under hay. So on a very rudimentary level, somebody's hid the bodies, but it's very easy for them to find. They could see automatically that they'd both been shot with a shotgun and they had been shot at point blank range. And they said that the way that they'd been killed, it was an execution style killing. This is not a non-intentional situation that's unfolded in an accident. This isn't somebody being disturbed whilst they're stealing from a home and they act in haste. This is somebody who has gone out of their way to absolutely make sure that Harry and Meghan are dead. Now, inside the farmhouse, one of the strange things that they noticed immediately is the table had been set for lunch and they'd even got out the couple's best china. Now, anybody who thinks about that thinks, who was coming round? I don't know about you, but I have certain items that I serve people when I'm having people around for food, and I have what we eat off. Same with my mugs. I've got my nice mugs and I've got my mugs that I drink from that often get broken. And I don't have to shed a tear. I have one specific mug I would say that I would shed a tear over because it's my favourite mug in the world. But the point is, you know what I'm talking about. You have your nice stuff, you have your normal stuff, you have your done-in stuff, all of which you give to certain people based on their relationship and experience with you and whether you're trying to put on a show. So they've set this table with the best china. That's unusual. Also, there was a teacup that had been set on the table, which means that it looks like somebody else has been prepared for. That teacup itself seems to suggest another person was going to be present. And the police indeed learned that that teacup was only ever used and that set was only ever used when an important visitor was present. It's somebody you want to impress, or it's somebody that you want round to be seen to have your house in order. There's a reasoning behind you putting out that kind of crockery and that kind of cutlery, etc., because you want to be seen to be people who are successful in certain ways. And you do that when you're putting on some airs and graces for someone. Also, there was lunch that had clearly been cooked on the stove, but it hadn't been eaten. So they actually considered that maybe the killer had stopped by unannounced. That would have explained why the stove had been turned off and why tea had been prepared. And also Meghan and Harry's respective favourite mugs, they'd been laid on the table alongside that fancy teacup. Neither of the Tuesdays had drunk from that teacup. That meant that they certainly had another visitor, doesn't it? It just makes sense that if they've got both of their favourite mugs on the table and then another mug has been brought out, well, they wouldn't be doing that for themselves. Also, they noticed that one of Harry's white shirts was actually laid out on the bed, and that would suggest that he was expecting somebody or was about to go outside. So he was preparing to either leave to go somewhere or to prepare himself to look a certain way when somebody arrived at the property. So these are all the things that they're musing about how this couple have been killed and who they have been killed by. So the first thing they have to do in the investigation is to consider all avenues, of course. So that one of the ways that they look at this is it a murder-suicide? No. They can tell that immediately. And the reason for that is there are drag marks that have clearly been made from a body going from the farmhouse to the cowshed. So they can see physically those drag marks. But then they bring in a forensic and ballistics analysis and they determine that Harry had literally been shot just outside the door of the cowshed. At that point, he was placed in the trough and he was actually covered with hay and tarpaulin sheets, so trying to cover the actual scene of the crime to some degree. Meghan, had actually been shot at the other side of the farmhouse. They think that she was shot possibly near the corner of the kitchen. And the police theorise that she was actually trying to escape when she was shot, which is just a harrowing thought. It's terrifying and devastating when people die by means that I'm talking about today. And to be executed at point blank range is beyond dreadful. But you would hope that if that ever were to happen, it would be quick. The idea of being able to consciously know that somebody is coming for you and to try to remove yourself from that situation and to fail, the feelings of fear and terror that would course through your body, the psychological distress, even if it's only for a moment, is just too terrible to imagine. Megan's body, that was also placed in the cow shed and again covered with a carpet. So this person, like I said, has wanted the bodies covered. Now that could be for two reasons. Of course, there is one that might seem more obvious, which is, well, they want to create some distance between them and the discovery of the bodies. They may not have thought the drag marks would provoke that kind of reaction. They may not have considered that the police would have been on the scene so quickly after them being killed, but they could have thought, give us some distance. People might come and knock on, might not see them in the home, but they won't immediately find the bodies. But the other thing is, particularly if you know somebody and you've killed them, you don't actually want to see them. You want them to be covered. You want to remove their physical being from that situation because it's something that's intimate. No matter what your feelings, to actually see your work, to know that you have killed someone, can be psychologically problematic for the person who's actually carried out the killing. So to take the bodies and to put them together in that cow shed and to cover them over, it's almost a way of denying the reality of what's just played out. If I don't see it, then maybe I don't have to consider it psychologically. So that could be another reasoning behind it. Now, the police believe the shots that were used to kill Harry and Meghan were number 7 shotgun shells. So they didn't actually find any cartridges at the time. But interestingly, number 7 was not the type of shot that Harry ever used. Now, no evidence was found that suggested the shotgun that was stolen from Harry earlier the year before had been used to kill him. So it wasn't as if they were connecting that gun with the killings I'm talking about today, but they didn't actually ever locate the murder weapon. Detective Chief Inspector Trevor Evans, he was the lead detective in this case, he said, the killings bear all the hallmarks of an execution. It was carefully planned. The killer knew his victims and they knew him. He knew their daily habits, their property and its layout. It's interesting that he uses the term he, isn't it? It's never a she. The assumption is always that the kind of person who would carry out this kind of killing is definitely going to be male. And he uses that gender-specific way of reinforcing and referencing this particular crime. When they carry out the autopsy, clearly they could see how they died. They'd been shot. But both victims had been shot once in the back of the head from around 2 to 3 feet away. Harry's body showed evident hypostasis on the side that he wasn't lying on. So they then concluded that he had been moved there around 3 to 4 hours after he died. Meghan's body, it showed significantly less hypostasis. Now that meant that she might have been killed some time after Harry, which again, is just harrowing. The idea that she would know that her husband had been killed horribly and that she too was awaiting her death is just devastating to comprehend. When they considered a motive, at first they thought, well, this looks like a professional hit because they'd been shot once in execution style. It just felt like this was very much a directed murder, that somebody had planned, premeditated, knew what they were doing, was prepared for it, and did it in very much hitman fashion. But ballistics experts actually said, listen, if this person knew how to use a gun, if they were somebody who was determined to go ahead and kill people, well, it could have been anyone. So even though it looks like an execution, it looks like somebody knows what they're doing, as long as they can handle themselves with a gun, then they could have gone ahead and done this. And if they had the measure psychologically and emotionally to be able to carry out something so appalling, well, you could have anybody as a suspect. The forensic evidence in the cow shed, that indicated that the killer would likely have been literally splattered with blood and body tissue, but there was literally no blood found anywhere else on the farm, which again is strange. Because if you had used a shotgun, and I'm sure that lots of you know how disastrous shotgun wounds are, but genuinely, it obliterates the person it comes into contact with, genuinely. And when it does that, if you are only 2 to 3 feet away, which is what they were suggesting was the case where these two people were killed, that the killer was literally 2 to 3 feet away, you would imagine that person would have blood, brain tissue, etc. on them. And yet there's nothing transferred anywhere else. So that leaves them a little bit confused, because that would seemingly suggest somebody who had a degree of sophistication forensically to be prepared to not transfer any of that, maybe to have brought an extra pair of clothes and to have something with them so that they can make sure that nothing's being left anywhere. If you were not used to this kind of situation, you may not be quite as meticulous over the crime scene. The police also quickly dismissed the possibility that the Tooses had been killed by an intruder, because that was one of the theories, but there was no evidence of a break-in. Nothing was stolen, so literally the jewellery that was in the house, the money in the house, that was all untouched. Harry actually had £75 on him when he died. Again, that wasn't stolen. So there's no motivation here that suggests that somebody is coming because they want to make some money quickly. It's all still present at the crime scene. Now, initially in this investigation, there are genuinely really few leads. As the ballistics expert has said, anybody could be responsible for this. There doesn't seem to be any clear motive as to why people would want Harry and Meghan dead. They're lovely. People like them. They're not people who've caused any issues in their life. It just doesn't make sense. There wasn't a motivation monetarily. So they're struggling. So then Crime Watch, which is a television programme in the UK, actually a friend of mine, is one of the presenters of Crime Watch, Rav Wilding. And he is somebody that today goes out and talks to people about cases that haven't been solved. And the whole premise of Crime Watch is to get that case out there to help people who may not have thought that they had a piece of information that was important, bring it forward just in case it fills that missing piece in the jigsaw puzzle. So on the 28th of September 1993, this is 2 months after the murders, they do a reconstruction and they launch this appeal on BBC's Crime Watch. It was said that very few people had ever even visited the Tooses' house. They weren't people who had lots of social experiences and occasions there. And so it was unusual for people to visit unless they either knew them personally or would have been there by appointment. So an appeal was made for any potential witnesses to come forward, particularly as the M4 motorway actually passes through Clonharris. So a lot of people will be passing through the area that may not have thought they'd got anything significant, and then this jolts their memory. Also, people were asked, if you know anything about Harry's stolen shotgun, come forward, because clearly they could have been completely unrelated or there could have been a sinister connection. Now, DCI Trevor Evans, he revealed that basically, despite an incredibly extensive investigation, there was literally no motive whatsoever for the murders, and that as far as he was concerned, it was the most baffling that he had ever encountered in his time. And it is baffling, because like I said, these two older people never said boo to a goose, never been a problem in the local area, killed in what seems to be almost a professional hit. That's something that's really confusing. And one of the things that the police start to look at is people within the Tooses' intimate space, the people that know them, love them, etc. And we know that's always how investigations go, because often, sadly, it's somebody that you know, even someone you care for, who kills you. Now, at the time of the murders, Cheryl, their daughter, lived with a boyfriend, Jonathan Jones. They lived in Orpington in Kent. They'd actually been together for 8 years. They'd met on a business studies course at the Polytechnic of Wales. Back in the day when we had universities and polytechnics, we only have universities now in the UK, but back in the days that I studied, you went to a polytechnic or a university, and they met at the Polytechnic of Wales. As a couple, they often visited Harry and Meghan at the farm together, and both Harry and Meghan were apparently very religious, which caused a little bit of an issue where Cheryl was concerned, because she actually moved in with Jones out of wedlock. So they were living in sin. And I appreciate that these days it is just the norm, isn't it? People genuinely move in together to test it out before you get married, for example, to check that it's not going to be a highly costly exercise when you divorce. But when I was younger, it was still considered living in sin. And if you are very religious, even today, that would be something that you might struggle with. But Harry and Meghan really didn't approve of this. And Cheryl knew that. So she actually kept it a secret from her parents. And Harry and Meghan were apparently absolutely devastated when she moved away anyway. So that would have been something that would have really upset them further. Now, they did eventually find out that Cheryl was living with a boyfriend. They struggled with it. They accepted it. They didn't throw her out of their lives and never want to see her again. Quite the contrary, they absolutely adored her. But they didn't approve of the fact that she was doing it. So they didn't actually go around and tell any of their friends. They didn't feel it was appropriate that she was doing that. Also, they had been together a long time. So 8 years is a lengthy relationship. You're obviously very established. They probably feel that the daughter should be married at that point, particularly because of the time frame they've been involved in the relationship. Now he, Jones, was also from Wales. And he was somebody who I suppose had an entrepreneurial spirit. He was trying and to some degree failing at the time to succeed in his job as a recruitment consultant. And he didn't like that feeling. So that entrepreneurial spirit meant that he decided he was going to create his own marketing business. Apparently he only had £100 in his bank account at that point, but God loves a trier. And at the end of the day, lots of entrepreneurs have become super millionaires because they have had that spirit to just go ahead, break free from the rat race and do something that's unique to themselves. Now, at the time of the murders, apparently Jones was falling behind on the house repayments and also the couple were about to lose their flat. Now, this is a fact that apparently Jones did not tell Cheryl, which is something that I find problematic. When it comes down to relationships, you both play a part. And if you are about to lose your home because you're not making the payments, it's certainly something you need to be having a conversation with your partner about. And the fact that he doesn't do that, well, that is going to make him seem a little bit deceptive. Equally, there are some people out there who just deny, deny, deny until literally the moment that they lose whatever it is that they've fought so hard to protect. And if he has a problem accepting that there is a D-Day coming and is just hopeful that he can create something that's going to change that situation and make the whole scenario better, then him not telling her in his mind might not be deception. It might be putting off the inevitable with the hope that he's going to be able to change the outcome with some miracle occurring. And he won't be the first person to do that. And also men are more likely to do that statistically. I guess part of that is to do with the idea that men are meant to know what to do and are meant to be providers. And then when they are failing badly, that's something that they struggle with emotionally and psychologically. Now, those financial difficulties are a big red flag to the police, as we know. People kill for love, people call for money. It's the reality that we hear play out day in, day out. Harry and Meghan had a £150,000 life insurance policy. So the police think, well, this could be a potential motive. He's struggling, falling behind on payments, maybe not getting where he wants in his career. Suddenly he's got £150,000 that he can use. And also there's a selling of the farm, etc. So that would mean that there was a pretty big payday coming. Also, a few days before they're murdered, the Tooses had actually been to visit a solicitor to talk about the will. So Jones apparently knew that Cheryl was the sole beneficiary of her parents' estate. So there's quite a considerable amount of money, particularly back in 1993, that's heading Cheryl's way. When it came down to the witnesses, numerous ones came forward and said, listen, we saw a man walking along the road near the Tooze farm in late June. And bear in mind, this is the place where most people would be driving because it's quite remote. And so that in itself pricked their conscience. He was allegedly wearing a beige trench coat and also dark sunglasses. So he kind of stood out. They described him as wearing a hold-all bag. And also, apparently, he was hiding his face from passing motorists. I mean, that just genuinely sounds like someone who's trying to draw as much attention to themselves as possible, isn't it? If you're going to try to do something in a way that makes you seem anonymous, don't walk around in a trench coat, wearing sunglasses with a holdall and looking away from traffic whenever they're coming near you, because immediately it just makes you look like you're somebody suspicious. Now, one witness actually phoned the police later in the investigations and said, I actually recognise the man. I recognise it as Jones. That's the person that I saw. Now, at that point, they speak to Jones. Of course they do. They've got a witness who said, I saw this man who's related to this family to some degree. And all these other people are saying that they have equally seen a guy matching that description who seems super suspicious. But Jones says, yeah, I was in the area. Absolutely. In fact, I was helping Harry bale hay and I'd actually got there by hitchhiking to Pontypridd. So he's actually admitting that, yes, he was present. And also he would be walking because he'd actually hitchhiked to get there. So that would fill in some of the gaps. Also, Jones did have a trench coat that apparently matched that witness description. And a lot of his friends actually said, yeah, I've seen him wear that regularly. Now, Jones and Cheryl, they actually denied this. They said he didn't own a trench coat. So they countered that particular suggestion. The police also suspected, though, that it could be Jones who'd stolen Harry's shotgun before the murders. Now, that would indicate something really chilling, because if a year earlier somebody has removed that shotgun and purposefully stole it, that would mean that they premeditated killing those individuals for a long period of time. And that is psychopathic beyond measure. Now, when it came down to the forensics, police found Jones's fingerprint on the teacup at the farmhouse. That's despite him and Gerald denying he'd ever used it. And apart from Harry and Meghan's own fingerprints, only Jones's were found on the items at the crime scene. Also, there's some concerns about his alibi. So Jones's alibi for the 26th of July 1993 was that he'd taken the Monday off, apparently had meetings with estate agents to find a new office for his marketing business in Orpington. But police could not find any witnesses or estate agents in Orpington who'd actually seen him or spoken to him on that day. Now, that's unusual because you're in estate agents, you are going to have notes of the people that you've met and where you've met them. And nobody has any of those. So at this point, the police are really homing in, shall we say, on Jones. And so they decide to figure out, okay, what's the return trip time from Orpington to Clonharry? How long would it take to get there and back in a day? And they found out it would take a maximum of 7 hours by car or train. And they then start to consider the idea that that would mean that it would possibly give Jones enough time to commit the murders that day and still be home in time to report the Tooses missing. So they figure it's not outside of possibility that Jones has gone ahead, murdered his girlfriend's parents and got back to act as if he's just had an ordinary day, planning whatever next for his business. Now, Jones also tells the police that he'd had a conversation with a lift engineer in his flat at 1:30 p.m. on the day of the murders. But the lift engineer and two other people who were working that day said that's just not true. We didn't speak to Jones. And in fact, the time that he's claiming we spoke to him, we were out at lunch. So it's curiouser and curiouser. Why is Jones introducing all of these ideas about how his day is played out that has immediately been undermined by people's testimony? People are literally saying that's not true, it didn't happen. Now, if his alibi could be undermined any further, well, he failed to return a rented videotape that was due back at a shop along the exact route that he claims to have walked that day, but he doesn't take it. And also, the exact time frame that experts suggested the murders took place were between 1:30 and 3 p.m. And they were the exact times that Jones said he was physically at home. So they're really starting to suspect that Jones has got something to do with these murders. Now, Cheryl, she actually later admitted to police that Jones wasn't at home when she returned from work that evening and that she genuinely couldn't, if she was honest, tell if he'd been in the flat that day or not. And Jones does, down the line, admit, okay, I lied. I didn't actually make any inquiries with estate agents that day, which is strange because if you're completely innocent, you have nothing to hide. The last thing you want to be doing when you're speaking to police officers is to be making up these false alibis that they're going to undermine immediately. That's going to make you be right within their line of fire when it comes down to imagining who's carried out the crimes. And what provoked the decision to actually make up those lies? Because like I said, it only makes him seem guilty. It certainly doesn't suggest that he's innocent. Also, there's some concerns about Jones's reaction when all this was playing out initially, where the crime was concerned itself. Cheryl had become concerned about a parent not answering the phone that evening, and she'd actually said to him, I want you to drive the 200 miles to Conharie to check on them, which is a big ask, isn't it? Now, she'd said that I can't go myself because I need to work the next day. But he went ahead and he set off. So between 10 p.m. and 11 p.m, he literally starts to drive all that way. But at 1 a.m, he calls Cheryl and says, listen, I'm still 66 miles away from the farm. Apparently he was at Lee Delamere Services on the M4, and he didn't arrive until 3 a.m. Now, he claimed the weather had slowed him down, and of course, when you're knackered, you need to pull over and have a coffee. And it's not totally unusual for a three and a half hour trip to take 5 hours, because I've done it myself. If I'm exhausted, I just want to stop and have some food and a drink and take some time to just gather myself before I start back off on the road again. If it's really bad weather, you can understand somebody pulling over and doing that at a service station too. But there was just something unusual at that time of night, that he's saying the weather's slowed him down and that he's not arrived when he should have, because by the time he actually arrives, the bodies have actually been found. So the suggestion there is he's trying to avoid getting there at a time where he'd be the person to discover the bodies. The police officer actually said that when he was told bodies had been found, his reaction was strange. There was just something odd about him. And everybody acts differently in traumatic situations. Surely finding out that your girlfriend's parents have been brutally executed is going to be terrifying. And for some people, you don't know how to react because you've never got an emotional reaction to connect it with. You've never been through anything like that. So it's wrong to suggest that everybody acts in a typical way. But we would expect shock. We would expect disbelief. I mean, you can expect to some degree with certain people, absolute screaming and horror that plays out as well. But just something that is so completely unusual for that person to experience will provoke an unusual reaction. But there's something odd about it. And they're immediately concerned about the journey that he talks about, because it's taken far longer than it should have. Google Maps basically says the journey should have taken about 3 hours and 25 minutes, took him about 5 hours. Again, I don't think that is so suspicious. Like I said, lots of us take longer when we travel because the weather might be bad, or we're just knackered and we just want to go and get some food and so on and so forth. Now, the police decide that the reason that it's taken him that long is that Jones had disposed of clothing and the murder weapon during the drive. That's a bit of mental gymnastics, isn't it, though? Sorry, but it is on the police's part that the extra time had been taken because he'd gone and disposed of the murder weapon and clothes, etc. There's no evidence for that. That's just throwing something in. And where would he have gone to dispose of that evidence? And why couldn't he just have been at a service station having a coffee and a sandwich? Now, after questioning both Jones and Cheryl, police genuinely felt that they just weren't telling them the truth. They were just withholding information. They were lying to them. Apparently, they said that Cheryl had dodged almost every single question they asked of her. And at this point, they feel there's enough circumstantial evidence to arrest Jones. And they charge him with the murders of Harry and Meghan Tews. This is just after 2 months after their murder. Get to the trial. In the trial, it's Mr. Justice Ruggia. Began on the 26th of January 1995. It was a big old trial. It lasted 11 weeks. Now, the prosecutor's case was led by the lead prosecutor, Pitchford. I say that very carefully because I want in my head to say Pitchfork, because that would be terrifying. Who's prosecuting me? Pitchfork. Sorry? Yeah, Pitchfork. That disturbs me greatly. I have a scene from some kind of horrible Disney movie where things don't end well for people. Shut up. You're getting your prosecutor and it's Pitchfork. Anyway, it wasn't. It's Pitchford. Now, this prosecutor said that when they looked at how this crime would have played out, basically, Orpington to Pontypridd, that was possible to do a return trip in a day. And they put forward this idea that Jones had caught the train from there in the morning, basically surprised Harry and Meghan. They'd have been making lunch at the time. So at this point, they get out of the good china, they make the tea. And the belief that the prosecutor puts forward is that maybe Jones was about to ask their permission to marry their daughter. And so they're all excited and getting out the posh china so that he can do that. Then after he's killed them, he would have gone back on the train, arrived back at the flat at 7:30 p.m. So the prosecution does a pretty good job of depicting Jones as this really motivated, greedy son-in-law, desperate for the cash, intent on killing the Tooses for their will money to secure his and Cheryl's future. Bear in mind, Cheryl is somebody who adores her parents, calls them every night. So Cheryl's life is going to be absolutely decimated by the death of her parents, and certainly she would not choose money over their lives. But nonetheless, the prosecution put forward a very strong case emotionally. Also, we've got witness sightings that the prosecution bring in. So Jones was identified as being on Tiger Lane near the Tooses' farmhouse on the morning of the 23rd of June, 1993. The prosecution said that the reason he was there then is he was doing a dry run, so planning the murders, essentially. They bring in a witness, Mrs. Gillian Lewis. This was actually an elderly woman who was travelling as a front seat passenger in a car driven by her daughter, Claire, at 11:30 a.m. She said, "Listen, I saw a man. He was over 6 foot in height. He was thin. He had a sallow complexion, quite a long pointed nose and chin, and his hair was dark and shiny." She also said that the hair could have been a wig. To be honest, that description sounds a little bit like Slender Man, doesn't it? But anyway, this pointy face, tall, skinny, dark, shiny hair, etc. Now, this particular witness said that she'd never seen this man before, but she later recognised him as accompanying Cheryl at the funeral of Harry and Meghan Tooses on the 23rd of September 1993. So that's when she realises, oh, that's the guy that I saw, that's the guy we passed in the car. Also, with respect, Jones did match the description. He's slim, he's 6'4", so quite a notable presence if you see somebody that tall. The prosecution also brought in witnesses Mrs. Stone, Mr. Sharp, and Mrs. Blythe. All of those also described seeing a man with a similar description on the same date. Now, bear in mind, what is the prosecution really going to labour in the court case? And we all know, because it's what each of us would be doing if we were the barrister in this case. We are going to be ripping to shreds the false alibi. And it's really damaging, isn't it? Why create a false narrative when you've nothing to hide? Even if the truth is, you have to say, I was crying into my cornflakes at home, doing nothing, worried about my house being repossessed. You've not got anybody who can identify that that's the truth, but that seems reasonable compared to, I'm just going to make up loads of stuff that didn't happen. So the prosecution just tear it down. Those two lift engineers that Jones falsely claimed he spoke to on the day of the murders, they come into court and say, absolute rubbish. So these guys, Bell and Horsted, said, that didn't happen. Now, with respect to Jones, he did claim to recognise from the 6 photos that had been shown to him by the police, the engineer that he'd spoken to at 1:30 p.m. He also did say, look, I've never seen Horsted, I've only ever seen this one. And he did pick out that particular lift engineer that he said he spoke to. They said, listen, we may have returned to the building from our lunch break anytime between 1:15 and 1:45 p.m. However, we have absolutely no recollection of speaking to Jones or seeing him that afternoon. That said, a lot of us don't remember things that happen, even when there's two of us. Doesn't mean that it didn't happen. It just means that we don't remember it. And often, if you have another person who reinforces that belief system, then it can be that a truth becomes a falsehood, because it could be that Jones did speak to one of them, but the other person is validating that that never happened, and therefore that reinforces that belief system. It doesn't mean it definitely didn't happen, but it's looking very bad for Jones. The fact that he's said these things, yes, he's picked out this guy that he says he recognised as the lift engineer from the pictures, and he's done that right, but the police will be thinking, well, you could have seen him around doing things at a different point and not spoken to him, just click that that's the face that you'll remember when you're in a situation like this. Also, a woman called Mrs. Davis, who's a neighbour of the Tooses, she gave evidence and said, listen, 8 weeks before the murders, Harry had a furious barney with someone outside the farm. So now the prosecution are painting a picture that there is some kind of bad blood between the Tooses and Jones. They bring in Dr. Claydon. Dr. Claydon is the person who carried out the post-mortem on Harry and Meghan Tews. And this person testified that by the time the bodies were actually recovered, rigor mortis was beginning to wear off. So time-wise, again, they're arguing, yes, this could well have been the situation that played out. He could have got to that home, murdered them, placed the bodies in the cowshed, got home, and that's in context with what we're seeing regarding the bodies. When it comes down to the defence, they obviously have to try to persuade the jury that this does not make sense, that there is no reason for Jones to have gone ahead and done what I've just talked about. So their defence is essentially to say to the jury, listen, somebody definitely killed them, but it's not our client. This has been carried out by someone that is still completely unknown to the police. So, yes, it looks quite incriminating that Jones has done A, B and C. But actually, as the ballistics expert said, anybody with any ability to use a gun could have carried out this crime. You're homing in on this man who essentially is living in London at the time and saying that he'd have made that round trip and managed to have got away with it. And we're saying that doesn't really make any sense. This is far more likely to be somebody who has come with an intention to kill this couple, who knows this couple potentially, and hasn't had to rush it through like it's being suggested Jones did. So this is their narrative. And they bring in some interesting evidence. So on the 20th of July, a Japanese four-wheel drive was actually seen being driven towards the Tewses. Now, that couldn't have been Jones. He was definitely at work on that day. And the driver reportedly resembled the man in the trench coat. So witnesses had genuinely seen a man in a trench coat that also matched that car driver. 12:30 p.m. on the 26th of July, a Suzuki vehicle actually clattered over the cattle grid at the bottom of the lane, leaving the Tewses farm. So somebody had gone, visited that farm, and then left. That was never traced. On the garden gate leading to open fields at the rear of the farm and on the main door frame, fingerprints, palm prints also were found. Couldn't be matched to either Harry or Meghan or to over 400 other people, including the Joneses. So that's curious. The fact that on the gate and the door, there's actually somebody's fingerprints and a palm print that don't match anybody. Now, as part of the case, the prosecution actually called Cheryl Tews. Now, I would say that this was also valuable to the defence's case too, because she said during her questioning that she didn't believe Jones had killed her parents. She loved her parents. She didn't want to defend somebody that was a murderer for the people that she loved. She said, yeah, Jones had had a trench coat, but he hadn't worn it since he worked in London in 1991. She also said, listen, that evidence on the cup, the fingerprint, that doesn't prove Jones's guilt. She said, first of all, there is absolutely no way on God's earth my parents would have got the fancy china out for Jones. He was part of the furniture. He'd been in my life 8 years. Why would they have gone ahead and got out fancy china for him? He would have just been given a standard mug. And also she said, that fingerprint could have come from 2 years earlier when there was a funeral. We used the china then. He was present then. So there are lots of reasons in her mind why he would have transferred his fingerprint onto that china. But for her, it's the instinct and intuition, the man that she knows, the man that she loves, the man that she stands by fully. She does not believe, even for a second, that he has purposefully and willfully taken the lives of people that she adores and also come home to pretend that their relationship could ever be the same again after doing it. So for her, it just defies logic and reason and her experience of the relationship that Jones had with her parents that he could have ever done anything so grotesque. Jones actually took the stand in his own defence. That's always a risky business because it comes down to whether the jury like you. Genuinely, we can talk in a million different ways about what a jury stands for, but they're human beings. And human beings form biases very quickly. It's how we survive. We make a decision, good person, bad person. And if there is anything about him that comes across negatively, that will really go against him, even if what is being expressed is actually something that's logical. Even if some of the things that are being said make him look like really he's innocent. Him being up there and speaking, it can really backfire. So of course, when he goes up there, he denies that he's murdered Harry and Meghan. He just repeats the same alibis as he'd given to the police before. So he's basically saying, I did speak to those operators of the lifts. Yes, I didn't do everything that I said I did, but most of it, it's true. And he actually said, listen, you can call me a murderer, but Harry Tews was like a father to me and I was like a son to him. So he talks about a very, very close relationship. And that's quite compelling, but it's only compelling if, as a jury, I'm looking at you and thinking, yeah, you seem like a stand-up kind of guy. Bear in mind, this man has had nothing previous, nothing criminal in his past, nothing that has stood out to anybody as if somewhere within him he has this malevolence that's so capable of executing two people who treated him like a son so brutally. But in spite of this, the verdict comes on the 6th of April, 1995. The jury deliberated for 2 days, and by a majority of 10 to 2, Jones was convicted on 2 counts of murder, and he got 2 life sentences. The judge stated that the murders of Harry and Meghan were ruthless and terrible, and all of us agree with that. Now, like we see play out in all court cases, they go for an appeal. Doesn't always get granted, but they go for the appeal. And Cheryl Tews actually said, even when that verdict came in, that she was absolutely dismayed by the verdict. She actually offered £25,000 reward for the information that would support Jones's alibi and prove him innocent. That money came from that £150,000 that she inherited from the murder of her parents. And so she's got this money and she's spending it on the guy who's just been sent to prison for 2 life sentences for killing her parents, for brutally executing them. And she is standing by him completely. Understandably, for the rest of the family, this was a betrayal. And so the relationship she had with other family members just broke down. They were very angry at her support for Jones, which is completely predictable and understandable. But there again, they've not been in a relationship with this man. And we all appreciate that we never fully know somebody. And of course, people can do terrible things without us realizing. Think about BTK. He was out murdering people whilst his family thought he was a great guy. This happens. But there is just something for Cheryl that makes it feel just incomprehensible that he would have killed her parents. Now, Cheryl's aunt, Meghan Tews' sister, she actually went to the press and said, why can't she let her parents rest in peace? I sat through every day of the trial and I'm happy that Jonathan Jones is where he should be. Cheryl has been totally blinded by the man. I think that after 8 years, you're not necessarily blinded by anybody. I think after 8 years of being in a long-term relationship with someone, you've seen the best, you've seen the worst. You put up with the good times, you put up with the bad times. That tends to be where you are 8 years down the line. It's not 2 years down the line. You're not still in the lovesick phase. You've gone through the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. You've stood by them because you love them, but also you see them as the fallible human being that they are. So I don't think it's too fair to say that she was blinded by him at this point, but I do understand the connotations of what's being brought forward. The suggestion is she's standing by him at a cost to the memory and loss of her parents. And also, this appeal will put the family through it again. It's going to provoke a great deal of rage and anger within them. Now, the jury members, they were really annoyed by the appeal as well. They were annoyed that people were talking about them getting the verdict wrong. In fact, one juror said, they're making us out to be imbeciles. We're all educated people. One of the ladies on the jury was a school teacher. I'm sorry, but I think he's guilty. Sorry, I'm smiling at that. It's just the idea that somebody would be like, there is absolutely no way the verdict is wrong. Why? I have good reason and faith in the system, but why? Juries have got them wrong. Yes, occasionally juries have got them wrong. But let me tell you, let me ask this question. Have any juries you've ever heard of had a school teacher on them? Yes, I think quite a few juries. Yes, right. Well, you know then that if you have a teacher on the jury, it's definitely the right verdict. Every teacher in the history of teachers have always been right. And therefore, I rest my case, Your Honour. Seriously, I love the absolute steadfast belief in the fact that there was a lady on the jury who was a school teacher, and therefore they were definitely right in their verdict. So in 1996, in April of that year, Jones actually appealed his conviction, and it was on a number of grounds, including technical claims that the judge misdirected the jury when summing up the prosecution's arguments. That's a big, big issue if that happens. At the Court of Appeal, Jones's defence, which was actually headed by Mr. Rees, he stated that his conviction was based on suspicion, speculation, and conjecture, which, with respect, a lot of convictions are based on. Believe me, it's pretty terrifying that a lot of convictions genuinely are based on those things as opposed to real hard evidence. Now, the judges who presided over this was Lord Justice Rose, Mr. Justice Dyson, and Mr. Justice Gage. When they brought forward the issues that were around his actual conviction, there were quite a lot of things that do cause concern. So the issues with the sightings. So Rees said in his argument, it was never proved that Jones was anywhere near the farmhouse at the time of the Tooses' deaths, which is pretty imperative to the case. Also, a man was seen at Pontyclun railway station that day, and the prosecution had managed to allege that that was Jones. But Rees had brought forward three witnesses at trial that said the man was definitely not Jones. So three independent witnesses had verified it definitely wasn't the guy at the train station. Also, a massive lack of forensic evidence. So at the appeal, the judges were told that the murders would have resulted in the killer literally being covered in blood, in brain tissue, but there was never any forensic evidence whatsoever to link Jones to that. They found nothing. Apparently, according to the experts, the killer would have been liberally splattered with blood and brain tissue. He'd apparently have been dishevelled from carrying tarpaulin sheets and also from moving bodies. That does sound pretty appropriate and accurate to state, and that indeed does make you rethink what we've been told by the prosecution. Also, another thing that they brought in was that Jones's sight is really poor. He wears glasses. And so the police took his glasses to examine the crevices of those glasses, but there's no traces of blood, there's no traces of tissue. And we can all appreciate forensically, you could have somebody who's very sophisticated and would understand to clean those glasses in bleach, for example. But I think for the most part, none of us will have thought about doing that when you consider glasses. You don't think to yourself that somebody who's killed is going to immediately be thinking to themselves, oh, I need to check that my glasses haven't got any tissue here. You just look at them, wipe them down. You're not thinking about those crevices. You're not thinking about how the blood and tissue on a microscopic level could find their way in there. But there's nothing in those glasses. And he would have been wearing them because he'd have struggled otherwise with dealing with this crime scene full stop. Also, the prosecution had basically said that the main motivation was money. That was the main reason why Jones had killed them. But that motive was eventually dropped. And the reason for that was that Rees very successfully said Jones and Cheryl Tooze, they earned £24,000 to £25,000 a year. They also paid very little rent. And he said they were rather well-off people, rather than people who were in dire financial straits. Obviously, there had been some issues because they'd made late payments. That's one of the things that Jones was trying to keep from Cheryl. But they weren't in a diabolical state of debt. He didn't uncover thousands of pounds in gambling debt, etc. So the way that Jones had been painted to the prosecution as this person who was sinister and hiding things and keeping things from his partner didn't really play out how it had been portrayed in court. The judge also had told the jury that the Joneses would have inherited £150,000 from the Tooze family if he'd married Cheryl. But saying that to the jury made no sense. They weren't married. They'd been together 8 years and they had no intention at that point of getting married anytime soon. So the money wasn't going to come to him directly. He may have benefited from some of it because Cheryl Tooze would have given some to him, potentially their bills would have lessened, etc. But he wasn't the direct recipient and he hadn't proposed to her at any point before or after to try to get his hands on it. And with respect, she was the sole beneficiary anyway. That money was all coming to her anyway, down the line. Same with the farm. It was hers, full stop. The verdict came on the 25th of April, 1996. and three judges allowed the appeal to quash the conviction. So basically, they agreed that it was not a safe verdict. They even went so far to decide not to order a retrial. They said it would be inappropriate. So those three judges, and it's a high bar when it comes down to an appeal, those three judges all agreed not only was he a free man, but he was a free man who must not be tried again. That when he left that prison, he walked free permanently. Now, when he walked out, he and Cheryl kissed outside the court in front of all the media, and I suppose something that was like an FU moment for them. And Cheryl declared that his release was a victory for love and a victory for truth. She said, "I have always said that Jonathan is innocent from the very beginning." I have to say, her steadfast love for him, in spite of what they went through, in spite of the prosecution, etc., it is pretty unusual to stand by somebody in such an amazing way, to know in your heart that they got it wrong, and to be willing to lose your family and friends over that. Cheryl has got a relatively unusual courage in my mind. Jones and Cheryl actually married after he was freed from prison, and they've later gone on to have a son together. They said it was essential for their sanity that they tried to move on from what happened. Now, that does, of course, leave the question, who killed Meghan and Harry Tews? And there have been subsequent investigations. So in the year 2000, as we know, these murders at this point have been legally unsolved. There have been two reviews of the case. And I will tell you, the results of these have never actually been made public. And the reason for that is they don't want to influence any future trial or retrial. Now, in 2003, on the 10th anniversary of the murders, police did reveal that they'd actually received an anonymous letter in November 2002. They've never published the contents, but they took it seriously. The appeal then was made for the author of the letter to come forward. Police said they genuinely think that the letter is genuine and they could get more information about this case if the person would come and speak to them. The police said that it had come from someone in the area, but they didn't know whether it was a man or a woman. And DCI Trevor Evans said he didn't think it was actually sent by the killer, but it seems like that person knows more about the killing. In 2003, a search had been carried out and the police found shotgun cartridges in a flooded iron ore mine shaft on nearby land. They were apparently in a black hold-all bag with red stitching, a zip, and Team Daiwa written in gold letters. DCI Evans stated that the original investigation had been given an anonymous tip-off that the items had been dumped in a mine shaft, but they had at that point been unable to search it because they couldn't get permission. Barrels of a shotgun were also found in a quarry only half a mile from the farm, and they were apparently from a double-barreled 12-bore gun, the same used as in the murders. Now, experts concluded that they'd been dismantled from a gun by someone with firearms expertise. So that in itself makes you go, so was this a hit? Was this somebody coming to kill these people mercilessly? Was this unrelated to anybody that they knew? In 2006, we got a new witness come forward about two cars that were seen near the time of the murders. So again, some gels filling in some blanks that they haven't released. In 2008, South Wales Police said all lines of inquiry had been exhausted, and at this point, the investigation was actually reduced. They also reported that the detectives no longer believed the shotgun barrels and ammo were related to the Tews murders. But that doesn't mean they weren't. And it is kind of strange that those tip-offs came and they did find these items. Now, interestingly, in May 2011, serial killer John Cooper, he was given a whole life tariff for the 1985 double murder of Richard and Helen Thomas and the 1989 double murder of Peter and Gwenda Dixon. And these were actually known in the media as the Pembrokeshire murders. Now, after Cooper was convicted, the detectives thought, are there some connections? Are there some similarities between Cooper and the Tews' murders? And there were similarities noted, so both the victims were shot at close range with attempts to hide the bodies, and Cooper always used a shotgun in his crimes. Also, they observed that there were very few double shotgun murders throughout the UK, so again, that's another connector, but they didn't find any conclusive evidence to link him to the case. And Harry and Meghan genuinely wouldn't have known Cooper. And this would not explain, therefore, why the best china was laid out, because that would mean they were expecting a guest. Also, one of the MOs of Cooper was that he'd steal from his victims, and there was nothing stolen from the farm. Police also found that Cooper wasn't actually familiar with the Clonharry area, even though he'd once attended a hospital appointment in Bridgend, Wales that year. So it was relatively close, but it wasn't as if he would know that area like the back of his hand. And one of the things that he did was he targeted areas he knew well. So all of the crimes that he committed were in Pembrokeshire, where he lived. And he also had a particular way of killing. He shot his victims in the face, and that didn't happen with the Two's murders. And still to this day, if you were to ask the prosecution who'd actually killed the Tooses, they would still stand by the fact that, as far as they're concerned, they got the right guy. They got the right guy in Jones. Now, on the 26th of July, 2023, so really recent, it's a year ago, basically, this is the 30th anniversary of the Two's murders. The case has been reopened. South Wales Police have launched a forensic review of the case because things change. What we can find out now about cases is something that didn't exist technologically back in the day. And that always makes me feel really content. Because there are people walking free who generally think they got away with murder, and all it is a matter of time. You know, their cell hasn't been locked with them in it, but it's coming. The bars are forming. The lock is being forged. And one day, they will be caught. In an interview with ITV, Jones, who's understandably been somebody who's had this guilt assigned to him by many, he talked about the fact there hasn't been a day in the last 30 years where we haven't thought about it. And most days talked about it in some aspect of this case, of the investigation. Mostly that has to do with the people we regard as suspects, potential avenues of investigation that weren't pursued, and also lamenting opportunities lost to pursue those investigations. So this idea that he looks now at how the police handled the case and how he feels that they decided he was the one who was guilty, and therefore they directed all their energies towards him instead of looking in other directions, and what was lost by them failing to look into those other potential avenues of investigation, that those opportunities that didn't arise because of the prejudice they held, in his opinion, towards him. Also, former BBC Wales journalist Penny Roberts, she was the first reporter on the scene in 1993. She reported the case throughout her career. She said that she remembers arriving to this terrible scene shortly after the bodies had been discovered. She said there was blood in the cowshed. It was such a sobering scene. And she said, I really hope the forensic review will finally lead police to the killer. She said, the community of Clonharry, Harry and Meghan's own family, really want justice now. At first, we all thought it was a random killer. Then it was almost like an execution. Either way, everybody was very frightened. And even now, 30 years on, there's rumour and gossip around those murders. And I think for them, for the community, they need answers. I don't know about you guys, but I'd love to hear about those rumours. I'd love to hear about those locals talking about what they think happened, because often there is truth in those tellings. There is truth in those stories. For now, this case is still unsolved. One man was sent to prison, served time for a crime he didn't commit. Maybe some of you aren't clear about the outcome of this trial being fair, either the appeal or the original conviction. I would love to know your thoughts. And as ever, when there are unsolved cases, if you were around the area at the time of these killings, if you didn't think any of the information that you had to give was really important, then go ahead and give it anyway. Those final parts of the jigsaw are often the parts that people didn't think were important but were crucial when it came to forming the true picture of what played out. Also, if you're the person who sent that anonymous letter, don't go to your grave knowing the truth. I wouldn't want to be the person who holds back such information when I meet my maker. And even if you're an atheist, truth is you don't know what's coming next. Always better to think about how it is to be the best person possible, in my opinion.
That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.